For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Let's go back and think about Romans 1 one more time. As predicted last week, we were going to come back this week and talk about if God is so good, why is His creation so evil? We were talking about how it's hard to be consistent with your own thoughts and your own actions unless you admit the reality of an infinite personal creator. And yet, to those who doubt the reality of God, they would come back and say, you're not consistent because you always talk about a God who's really good, and yet His creation doesn't show any sign of that. If God was really good, He would want to stop evil on the earth. If God was all-powerful, He'd be able to stop evil. Yet, evil exists. So, one of these statements must not be true. We want to think about that. We want to think about, also, the question, what has God done about evil? Has He done anything about evil in the world? Let's start with this picture. I hope you can see this, because I want us to think a little bit about it. It's a pretty savage shot here. You see a Nazi soldier getting ready to murder a defenseless Jewish peasant and have his body flop into the pit along with the other bodies. The guns lined up. Behind him, a group of soldiers standing around watching, chatting, a couple of them smiling, obviously enjoying this. Evil exists. We're looking at something that is not just maladaptive, not just a culturally constructed notion of evil. It's not simply that our particular culture thinks this is wrong. Theirs thought it was okay. Nazi culture felt that this was what was needed. And if we're going to argue, well, I think just every culture makes up their own moral norms, you know, I think that's true from the standpoint of what is. But that's a different question when we say what is compared to what ought to be. How do we get from the is to the ought? Are we saying if we say every culture makes up their own moral norms, are we saying then for them there was really nothing wrong with what they did here? That this guy basically was doing good? Well, I just can't buy that. I don't think any of us can buy that. His culture may have said it was okay, but yet there's still such a thing as an overarching concept of moral right and wrong. There is evil, real evil, not just culturally defined evil. And these days, we have to start at this point. In our postmodern era, people are becoming more and more reluctant to point at anything and say, that's just plain wrong. In the U.S. News and World Report recently, they ran an article about how philosophy professors around the country are noticing that their students are reluctant even to point to the Holocaust and say that that was morally wrong. Because once they say, well, that was evil, then they've crossed a threshold. And the next thing you know, maybe shooting this guy is wrong. Maybe something right next to that is also wrong. And so we started on a process of trying to delineate good and evil. And you can see where this leads is into the need for universal moral norms, rights and wrongs, something that postmodern thinkers don't want to hear about. But I'm submitting to you, this picture is portraying something to us that is indeed evil for all peoples and all times. What culture you're part of has nothing to do with it. Now, the existence of evil is a problem, as I said, for believers in an infinite personal God, a creator God. That's a problem for us. But it's not only a problem for us. As a matter of fact, let's think about atheism. We already talked a little bit about this. Atheists have a problem with evil because they can't even say what it is. Remember the illustration of the pouring the vinegar on the soda and how it fizzes? It's just a physical event. It has no moral content. To the atheist, the whole world is a physical entity, and it's impossible to get from materialistic beginnings to the idea of a moral right and wrong. Whatever is right. If this guy shoots this guy, That's probably because of social forces and chemical, genetic, and social forces that basically determined that he would do that. So it happened. To them, the whole world is going to fizzle out and disappear eventually. When our sun goes into a nova, so that won't matter either. The fact that we ever existed will be forgotten by all for all time. So what difference does it make what happens in the meanwhile? At the most, the atheist could say, well, some things are disadvantageous to the survival of the species, but that's different than moral thinking. And it also contains already a moral judgment, which is that our species should survive. Why should we be the only species to survive? When we study the fossils, we find that millions of species have come and gone. Why should ours be the one that survives? In fact, wouldn't the world be better off without us? The problem with this statement is that we're beginning with a value already laid down and to argue values. So it's a circular argument. Well, what I'm talking about in that picture is not something that's unwise or disadvantageous for the survival of the species. I'm talking about something that is morally wrong. Whether it's an advantage or not has nothing to do with it. And so this is a completely different concept. We could think of pantheism, the belief that God is in all things and all people. They have a problem with the presence of evil as well, as we went over and touched on last time. According to pantheists, God is in all, including evil. The man who's about to be shot, God's in him. But the man doing the shooting, God's in him too. For pantheists, everything is a part of an all, a harmonious all. And to see divisions like good and evil is unenlightened thinking. If we really see things as they are, we realize that we shouldn't make those kind of dichotomies. Well, I suggest to you that's a real problem then. They also argue that the whole world that we're in where we see evil things happening is an illusion. They use the word Maya to describe this world, which means in Sanskrit, illusion. The veil of tears in which we live doesn't even really exist. And so there is a denial, similar to in atheism, there's a denial of the problem of evil, denial even of the existence of evil, and that's how we resolve it. And so the sense of moral outrage, the sense of the certain intuitive sense that what we saw in that picture is flat wrong, flies directly in the face of pantheistic thinking. Then two, karmic law. According to pantheists, if somebody gets their arm cut off, if somebody's sick and they die, this is the result of something they did in a previous life. And so there's a cause and effect relationship. We're locked into this karmic machine, a wheel that's turning in samsara. And to try to relieve that suffering, to try to oppose it in some way, would be to oppose the laws of karma. And so as a result, in pantheistic thinking, there's a lack of incentive to resist evil or to fight social wrong. So you see, both the atheist and the pantheist have severe problems when we get into this issue of the presence of evil, not just believers in an infinite personal God. Let's talk about animism. This is the number one religious and philosophical worldview in the world today and throughout history. This is the belief that all things in nature are animated by spiritual beings. When we think of American Indian religion, that's animism. And still today, there are thousands of different animistic cults around the world. Even many of the major religions, for instance, in Asia, where Taoism is really a very abstract pantheistic doctrine. If you go to a Taoist temple, they're practicing animism. They're now offering idols and making offerings to local spirits. So popular religion is often actually animistic. Animism, the belief that whatever happens to us is the work of a spirit being. A good spirit, a friendly spirit, or a demon, an evil spirit. In animism, which, although there's so many different varieties in the details of animism, the underlying thought is remarkably similar everywhere we go. They're very, very similar when we get into shamanism or animism. In all of these cults, as a rule, there is no problem of evil. To them, their gods are also evil. The gods who created the world, they lie, they cheat, they murder, they commit adultery. All of the same avarice, greed, and so forth that we experience, the gods can be seen this way too. And in many cases, humans were created by the gods for evil purposes so that they could be used as slaves. So this question that we raise, how could the world be evil if a creator God exists, never occurs. That question never comes up in the literature and the folklore of animistic religion. Of course, I don't think that all things are the result of spirit activity. When we see a storm approaching and lightning shooting out of it, we no longer believe this is a god approaching us or a demon. We've come to realize that lightning is caused by something other than that. So I think there's a superstitious element here too, but it applies to the problem of evil because, again, if someone's sick, if a plague hits, if someone gets run over, that's not just a question of cause and effect in the Western sense, because to them that would be the product of some sort of demon activity. So the gods are a big part of the problem, actually, in animism. And the key to life becomes appeasing them or avoiding trouble with angry gods, getting gods to work for you. The whole thing is a big manipulation thing. Healing. They have taboos, but taboos are completely different, again, than moral thinking. In taboos, the issue is usually to keep from offending or encroaching on a god. And many times, the actions that are prescribed by taboos have no moral content at all. Like, for instance, that you shouldn't fish on Wednesdays because that bothers so-and-so, a certain deity nearby. Or you shouldn't mix this seasoning with that one on your plate because that could upset a nearby wood deity in the woods. Very common to find that these taboos are extremely narrow, specific, and trivial. And so that's not moral thinking because you don't have moral principles that you can apply in different situations as they come up. Like you just take the idea of honesty, telling the truth. You know, that's not saying if someone asks you this, you should answer that. It's more of a principle that we can take into different situations and see, am I being honest here or not? That's what moral thinking is. Big difference between taboos and morality. Well, this is well understood by anthropologists and philosophers. So you see, no matter where we turn, and you may be one like a lot of people who think, how would we ever get to know, all the possibilities as far as religion and philosophy in the world? There must be thousands of worldviews that people have. I'm not a scholar. I just work at a paint store. And I can't be learning all this stuff. Interestingly, the four worldviews I've mentioned, atheism, pantheism, animism, and theism, which is the biblical idea of one infinite personal God, really embraces all the worldviews on earth. There's virtually nothing that won't fit into one of those four categories. So it's not impossible to know something about comparative religion or philosophy. It could be argued that postmodern outlook is kind of a new worldview, but it borrows from the other four, especially from pantheism and from animism. Theism, that's the belief in a creator God. That's what we've been talking about. This is what Paul says in Romans 1 when he says, that which is known about God is evident within them, having been clearly seen through what has been made. We can look at the creation and see there must be a creator, there must be a designer. In theism, in the biblical worldview, and there's more than one theistic outlook because Judaism is theistic, Islam is theistic. Of course, interestingly, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, the major theistic worldviews, all derive from the Bible, all derive from one ancient book. It's interesting, isn't it? Anyway, let's just stick with what I'm calling the biblical view. What does the Bible say about evil, the problem of evil? As the one who has looked into this, one who has lived as an atheist, one who has studied other religions, one who has been bothered by this issue of the problem of evil, I'm one who has been bothered a lot by that. And today, I would say I've never found anything so satisfying as the complete answer that we're provided with to this problem found in the Bible. No other worldview can match it. And in fact, the others are full of contradiction. We have to begin by understanding this biblical notion of personhood, that there is such a thing as a personal being that is different from animal beings, different from plant life, different from a bottle of chemicals. And when we come to people, we are personal beings, and the Bible starts out with the argument that God said, as he created the different types of animals and life and so forth, he said, it is very good, it's very good, it's very good. But when he came to humans, he said something different. Let us create humans in our own image. And he breathed into them the breath of life. And so according to the Bible, humans are not just a different shape, a different size, or a different size brain than other animals. But that's a quantitative difference. Humans are qualitatively different because we alone are personal beings. We have self-awareness. When you sit in your bed, suddenly your thoughts can go inward. You see yourself sitting there, looking out, your past, your future. You're aware of yourself as an existent being. Self-awareness. Something that researchers have good reason to believe is not true with other animals. They don't see themselves reflexively. They're not self-conscious in that sense. I look at myself and I know I'm a being. I know that I'm more than an object. And all of the aspects of feeling, desire, memory, and cognition tell me I'm this kind of being. Ask yourselves, why are people more destructive, more evil, as it were, than other species? This kind of thing we see in the picture here, the realization that here was an episode where a group of people killed their own kind, not for food, not for territoriality, but just out of the sheer cruelty, the amazing cruelty. We find the same thing happening still today. These atrocities in Bosnia, proportionately, are probably on the same level as World War II. You realize nothing has changed in the world. Worldwide, we're seeing every day atrocities being committed by humans, the destruction of the natural world by humans, in a way sometimes that just seems so wanton, so flagrant. The bloodthirstiness, the thrill of killing. What is it about the human species that makes us more brutal, more aggressive, more savage than other animals in the world ever dreamed of being? It's because we are personal beings. And to be a personal being means whether for good or for evil, either way, we are more significant. We can get up and look out, as I just did a couple weeks ago from the Sears Tower, and look at this marvel of modern technology, of an ocean of light rising up. And we realize humans are amazing to have come up with this. It's like nothing else that exists. It's fantastic. There's a beauty and a marvelous aspect to human beings. But then if we think about it a little bit longer, we realize every one of these streets out here in front of us is the misery and agony and the violence. We're going to have to avoid certain parts of this town or we might get rubbed out or robbed. There's really the beautiful, the marvelous, and the obscene are both there with the human race. And that picture is going to accord perfectly with what the Bible teaches. Human sexuality Boy, is it ever different than animal sexuality. You know, when you think of animals, all animals have sex except, you know, the smallest asexual creatures, but certainly higher level animals, let's just think of mammals, they all have sex. And yet, they only have sex when the female's in estrus, when she's fertile and can produce offspring. With humans, our sexuality has nothing to do with being fertile. And in fact, human females can and do show interest in sex for pleasure and communication at any time, every day possible. We're so unusual in that regard. Even the one species of chimp that's been found where there's evidence of a female orgasm or at least female pleasure in sexuality and mating facing one another, they still only do it when she's in estrus. We're the sole exclusion to that rule. And, you know, when you come to Genesis 1, God talks about sexuality between the man and the woman, and he says, not that sex is for procreation. That's a secondary part. For us, he says, sex is so that the two may become one. It's an act of union and of celebration and appreciation of two personal beings coming together to enjoy that with each other. And that is very interesting because that description does fit how our sexuality actually works. Whereas there's not any, even a partial similarity in any other species on Earth. Where are the intervening species? You know, if humans are just like the rest of the animal order, then where are the intervening species, for instance, in the area of intellect? Animals have intellect. It would be a mistake to say that they're not intelligent. They have intelligence. As a matter of fact, this has been studied and measured. And we could set up here a graph of intelligence starting from the smartest creatures measured, like chimpanzees, down to other simians and down through other mammals and so forth, down to reptiles and all the way down to an amoeba. And the hundreds of thousands of species that exist would fall on this continuum very closely packed to each other. Only an expert could tell the difference in the level of intellect between any two points on the line that are next to each other. They would be so close, it would be very hard to tell the difference. And then at the end, all of a sudden, this radical jump, and here are human beings. Radically out of place from the others. Why is that? Why isn't there a continuum from us into the other animal forms? That's what you would expect under a Darwinian model. But what we actually see, this radical discontinuity between humans and other animals, is exactly what you would expect from the biblical account that humans were created in the image of God and he imbued us with an added portion of intellect. Everywhere on earth, humans are interfertile. Everywhere on earth where we find humans, even in the deepest and most isolated island, the deepest jungle, they're all humans. They're all interfertile with one another. Not like you would find, for instance, with monkeys or different species of fish. Everywhere on earth, a human is a human. Their intellect is the same the world over. Differences are negligible if they exist at all in intellect level. Why don't we find some intervening types between us and the rest of the animals? Wherever we go on earth, now and through history, we find humans practicing religion, the belief in the supernatural and the afterlife, which we can tell either from their words, what they believe, or from their actions, the fact that they bury their dead in rose petals, the fact that they build monuments, that they offer sacrifices. There is this whole religious, spiritual self-perception that humans have all over the world and throughout time. Naturalistic anthropologists tell us, well, there were so many different types of hominids. Some of them are religious, some weren't. Where are all the others? We can't find any examples. And when you get into this area, there is a motive for why naturalistic investigators would want to find an example of humans who don't have these characteristics, because that would be the missing link then. that would prove that we don't need God. You remember the incident with the National Geographic in the 70s reported on the Tassadai, this tribe in the Philippines that was so primitive. They had no concept of good and evil. They intermarried and bred with each other at will. They had no religion. And I read this as a believing Christian in the 70s, and I was bothered by that. It just made you stop and thought. You thought, where does this fit into the biblical narrative? If these are human beings, how could they be missing these basic qualities that are part of the definition of being made in the image of God, of being a person? I was very stumbled by it. I wondered if I could really trust my Bible. And all I came away thinking was, I just wondered whether the scientists involved maybe had missed something. They missed something, all right. They missed a lot. It turned out there's no such thing as the Tassadai. The whole thing was a ruse, a con that had been pulled off by some locals there. They knew these naturalists, modernist anthropologists, wanted to find the missing link. And they hired some local farmers to get naked and to run out in the woods and tell them all these things. And so a few years back, 2020 did a special where they went back and met the Tassadai. And they showed them the picture of them there with a stick in the woods and their hair on. And here's the same guy. And they'd show him, it's him, all right, wearing, you know, dressed like us and saying, yeah, they paid me $100 to do that. No, there's no tribe like that. There's no tribe that's missing these basic human qualities, because worldwide we are personal beings. Moral emotions. Heck no, there's no tribe that doesn't believe in right or wrong. We may not agree on what right and wrong is, but all humans know that there's such a thing. And aesthetic fascination. The arts. Boy, talk about a waste of time. You're going to spend weeks generating and painting a picture that can't feed you, that can't clothe you, that can do nothing except sit there and be an object of beauty. How is this adaptive for a species to spend all this time and effort on something like that? And yet, we find that everywhere we go again, now and back through history, the most primitive, simple tribe of people in the deepest forest, they love it. They love art. They love music. And no exceptions. We're all alike. And we love to create beauty with our hands. We love to create beauty with our voice and so forth. Just like God, who is also very creative and he enjoys creating things. We're like God in these senses. We share a common aspect with God, which is our personal aspect. Even as we share a common aspect with the rest of the animal order, which is our biological part. We're a blend of the biological and the spiritual. The more you think about it, the more you realize this perfectly matches what I see. Perfectly matches it. Personhood. Very important concept. Why is it so important? Only a personal being can do something that is morally evil. A guppy might eat its own young. And however you feel about that, you really can't say that it's morally wrong that they do that. You really can't chide them that this is evil. Perhaps a lion fights with another pride. Lions may fight over territory and they may kill. But, you know, that's lions. That's okay. You hate to see it on one level because you feel sorry for the dead lion. But I wouldn't want to say that it's morally evil, because they're animals. They're not personal beings. Only personal beings can be held accountable. My son takes a stick and beats his brother. I set them down. I don't chide the stick for his part in this violence. I follow the stick back to the last personal being that was wielding it. That's the one who's at fault. We know these things. It's very obvious. To be personal also then has to imply that we are non-programmed beings. Last week we talked about the idea of setting yourself up a tape recorder that you can push the button and have it say, I love you, I love you. You're special to me. And then you get home and you feel lonely. You sit back in your chair and go for a few, you know, I love you. You're cool. Boy, it's just not rewarding. Why? That machine can't love me. I programmed that machine to do that. I programmed that. It's not doing anything that it's deciding to do. It's doing what it was programmed to do. That's a machine. That's not a personal being. You realize this is true with your dog as well. You know, you can teach your dog to stand or sit. But again, you train them to do that. And so there's a qualitative difference there. When God brought the animals to Adam and named them, it says no one was found corresponding to him. He looked at all the animals. They were great. He loved them. He gave them names. But none of them corresponded to him. They were all different. None of them were personal beings. Of course, if someone is forced to do something, then we can't blame them for what they did. They were forced. The element of free choice has to be there before we can assign moral responsibility. So if we're programmed beings, if someone is making us be what we are, then we're innocent and we have no responsibility. But if we're personal beings and we're making choices about what we do, then we are responsible. And this is the final point having to do with personhood. If I'm a person, if there's such a thing as a personal being, someone who can decide to do what they want, someone who has that freedom, and I go out and I do something that's wrong, whose fault is that? It's my fault. If God made me in such a way that I could do nothing but that, then he's to blame. But if God made me as a free choosing being, and this is the word F-R-E-E, real freedom, freedom to do what I want without programming, then the only one that can be responsible for what I do is me. So, according to the Bible, the first humans were made this way. And they used this freedom. My friend says to me, yeah, well, why didn't God just make free choosing beings that wouldn't rebel against him? Right? We talked about this last week. That's like saying, why didn't God just create a round triangle? If they're free, F-R-E-E, choosing, then he can't make them so they won't rebel. If they're free, then clearly they could rebel. They have that ability. And if God decides to go out into the universe and to create personal beings with that level of freedom, the possibility is there that one day one of them is going to use that choice the wrong way and we're going to have evil. The Bible declares that the early humans used their choice this way, elected to move into self-rule, the evil that came with it, said they didn't need God's leadership. And ever since then, the human race has been very damaged. What they did had a catastrophic effect on their own children. Even the environment was affected because God, having been excused and dismissed by them, has taken his hands off to a great extent. And we find that humans, deciding to run their own world, have not been able to control it and to keep themselves out of trouble with nature. Each one of us is born already damaged because of this fallen state. The doctrine of the fall, that we were created one way, but we used our free will to turn a different direction. And this has affected even those not yet born are already affected by these choices. We say, well, that's not fair. They didn't make the choice. Well, fairness only applies in an unfallen world. If God was running the world, it would be fair. But once the world is fallen and we've basically thrown God off, anything can happen. Justice is not ruling this world. If you believe that this world is just, I think you need to think about that a little longer. There's nothing fair about this world. And people are affected by other people's decisions. If someone pushes the button for nuclear war, we're all going to be affected. You say, that's not fair. Well, boom, baby. It happened. I'd like you to look at this picture again here and really think about what's going on in that picture. You know, this guy probably had children. they may already be in the pit below him. And he did shoot him. This wasn't just a posture they struck. I've seen this sequence of pictures. He shot the guy, killed him. Now I'm asking you, really in a very serious way, what should God do to this guy? This guy, right here. What should he do because of what he's doing here? What do you think? Nothing? When this man comes to meet God, should God say, "Oh, well, you probably shouldn't have done that, but whatever." Huh? Is that what you think? You think that he should reward him? That's what the universalists think. They say, "Oh, God's just going to bring everyone to heaven. I'm sure of it." Really? This guy here? The others approving? What does this tell us about God then? What kind of God? I think if God has the same response to evil that he has to good, I think we're in a lot of trouble. Don't you? That's an amoral God. That's a God who could be, he could do anything. No justice, no responsibility. Should God apologize to this man, the killer, for saying, "I'm sorry I made you do that"? Is that what we think? Or should God judge this person? Should he hold him accountable for this and say, "You're going to answer for that"? If we believe that we're personal beings, if we believe we're making free choices, if we think that free choice makes you responsible for what you do, we're going to answer the last, that God should judge someone that does this. That's the reason the Bible says we're personal beings, we're choosing beings, we're moral beings, and therefore we're also evil beings and we stand under the judgment of God. Even though we're born damaged, we still make our own choices for evil all the time. Now this is what Paul's talking about in the book of Romans, chapter 1, verse 21, a passage on the judgment of God. It says in verse 21, "For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they came futile in their speculations and their foolish heart was darkened." Humans deciding what they think reality is about, not wanting to face the truth that there's an ultimate, infinite creator that they answer to. They don't want to look at that. That's menacing. That infringes on my autonomy. So I bring God down to something that I can put in my closet and close the door. To the tree out here. We'll pray to the tree. Unless we decide to chop it down and use it to cook with. But we would rather worship the creation, which is manageable, rather than the creator. That's what he says in 22:23. "Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Therefore, God gave them over in the lust of their hearts to impurity so that their bodies would be dishonored among them." What would God do to a race of personal beings who have said, "Get out of here, God. We'll take it from here. We don't need you anymore. If we want to commit evil, that's our business"? What would God do to a race like that? I bet maybe he would come in with fury and a consuming fire to destroy them. Actually, according to this passage, he does something even worse than that. He says to them, "Okay, you do it your way. You may go. You have your freedom." He gave them over, it says. And we read again and again that they exchanged the truth of God for a lie, worshipped and served the creature rather than the creator. Because of this, God gave them over to shameful lusts. Just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God, he gave them over to a depraved mind. Repeatedly in this passage, it says God's response was, "Let them go." And so a vicious cycle begins which could well lead to a point of despair in our lives. And certainly God would hope that we would reach a point where we're sick of living without Him, where we've tried the other way ad nauseum and we finally realize this is leading nowhere, and perhaps we'll come back to Him and say, let's rethink this. Maybe you and I should be together after all. And this would be all for the good. But according to the Bible, until that happens, the whole human race is hopelessly mired in personal sin and evil. And then we have a God who is determined to judge wrongdoing. It's not a good situation. This brings us then to the sin graph. This is the way we like to look at things, okay? Shooting a defenseless old man, that's bad. That's way up there. Now, on the other hand, my lying, selfishness, disregard for God, maybe a sex incident or two, whatever, some stealing, I don't know, this or that. I mean, maybe I've done some things, but I mean, it's nothing like what that guy's doing. Nothing like that. And so we say, probably when it comes to judgment, I'm not going to say that God shouldn't judge that guy, or that he should do nothing, that he should reward him. I'm not going to say that. You know, that guy doing that, yeah, I guess probably he does deserve to be judged. And probably, you know, anyone like guilty of these types of things, these people deserve to go to hell for that. All right. Now, when we think, well, what is God's view of this situation? It's similar, but it's different. He's got a little bit longer lines underneath the things. And he would agree that shooting the old man is worse than maybe your disregard and selfishness. Yes, those aren't equal. But on the other hand, all of them are a lot worse than we like to think. Our living a life disregarding God, not following Him, is considered, from God's viewpoint, pretty bad, actually. And God says that this curve isn't as steep as you imagine. And that, in fact, it's not just the right half that deserve condemnation, but the people that deserve to go to hell include all these bars. Anyone guilty of any of these bars deserves to go to hell. And that's going to wind up including the entire human race, deserving of the judgment of God. So we've got a very ominous picture before us here, according to the biblical view. This is a desperate situation. We're stuck in evil. We're all guilty. We've fallen short of God's standards. And God is prepared to judge. I'd like to roll a movie right now, produced by Dan Beach, one of our own here, that gives us a graphic portrayal of this problem. And then we'll talk about it for just a minute. I hope you understood the pretty powerful graphical message that Dan put into this movie. According to the Bible, God has not left us chained, imprisoned by our own departure from Him. God has not left us lost in this mire of evil and destruction. What we read is that at the cross of Christ, God came and absorbed His own judgment into Himself. This amazing twist to the story. Because as much as God resents the direction that the human race has gone, as angry as He is about that, the fact remains that He deeply loves human beings. Each one of us here is beloved by God. You can imagine having a son or a daughter who grew up and became a really bad person, a killer. And yet you may still love that son in spite of what he's become. And that should help us to understand our Heavenly Father and how He feels toward us. The Bible declares that God was so burdened by the way we live and His need to judge it that He decided on a solution so radical, no one guessed it until it occurred, that He would come in person, put on humanity, and allow Himself to be nailed to a cross and there experience the wrath of God for human evil. We can have this gift, but we're still personal beings. He still has not come to program us. He has not come to turn us into machines. And that's why the choice, the free choice, is still up to us. Really, what God accomplished at the cross was that He provided an alternative, a way out that we could never have had without that. Today, He offers us relationship with Him. All of the evil of the world sucked onto Christ at the cross and judged there, so that we can set the issue of our evil lives aside and come to God now. The only thing that is left is for us to come to Him for relationship. This is the message of the book of Romans. It's about that relationship. And it may well be tonight that you as a personal being could be sitting here inwardly knowing that what we're saying here is true. You may well look at your own life. You may conclude, I've been pursuing my way, lo, these many years. It's not really leading anywhere. I'm depressed. I'm lonely. I don't know what I want to do. I'm lost. And in light of that, this may be the night that you decide, I'm just going to use my power of free choice, and I'm going to make a decision. I'm going to call out to God, and I'm going to ask Him to show me this relationship that I can have with Him. Forgive me for the things that I've done wrong, low on the sin graph or high. It doesn't matter. I need to be forgiven. Forgive me and let me now begin my personal relationship with You, God. And if you pray that to the Lord tonight, He's going to answer your prayer and you're going to begin a new life of the Spirit from this night forward. Next time we get together, we're going to study about how the religious are really no better off than the rest of people. You know, people sometimes like to think that they're more righteous because they're more religious. And according to Romans, we're going to read that the religious are in the same hot water that all the rest of us are. And also that they need the same solution. All right, do we have any comments or questions, Sam?
Hey Dennis, I've got a younger brother who's mentally retarded. And is there any scripture that speaks to those individuals who may not be able to comprehend or understand the difference between good and evil, or maybe even the Lord itself?
Okay, a good question. What about those perhaps who are born mentally retarded or who are in some way infacilitated through illness, mental illness, what have you? Are they responsible for evil? The evidence is rather clear in the Bible that they're not. We're taught that people are responsible for what they know, not for what they don't know. We find in the case of young children that children who die at a young age before they reach an age of accountability, whatever that is, are automatically taken to heaven. And we find this, for example, when David says of his infant son who died that he will see him in life eternal. So without getting into a real lengthy discussion on it, the evidence is pretty good biblically. I think it's clear that if you are not responsible because you're incapacitated or too young, then the principles of judgment don't apply to you. This is what it says here in Romans, that which is known about God is clear so that they are without excuse, is only true for those who are able to see these things. If they weren't able to see them, the implication is, well, then they would have an excuse. And certainly there are people in that category.
Yeah, I think a lot of Christians and non-Christians both, I have a question about prayer. You made the point that God kind of, you know, said to Adam and Eve and humankind, I'm going to let you go in a way. And I think people sometimes struggle with, why do we pray? And my question is, and I'll be specific because that's a big question, but let's say, you know, somebody's ill or there's something physical, you know, that, you know, a lot of physical things in the world that sort of, you know, you think they're just going to happen anyway. I and other people struggle with, well, why do we even pray to God to ask Him to intervene? So how should we pray and why should we pray in a lot of circumstances when we see evil and bad things happening?
Well, this is a real good question. If God is taking this hands-off approach, then why are we praying to Him like that He's going to do anything about healing someone or about preventing an evil from happening? I don't want to speak in a way that's interpreted too extreme here. When I say God is hands-off, I say that He's relatively hands-off. When we speak of naturalism or atheism, they see the world as being just cause and effect in a closed system, that it's cause and effect with no outside influence. As Christians, we believe in cause and effect in an open system, where God is free to intervene. The fact that Christ came shows that God intervened in that situation. Also, He will intervene periodically, according to His will, often in answer to prayer. This is why prayer does make a difference. We're not saying that God can't intervene or that He never intervenes, but we're saying that He has substantially kind of taken hands off and let cause and effect roll along. When He does intervene supernaturally, we call it a miracle, an intervention by God into history. He's not controlling the whole world. So when someone dies, people say, "Why, God? You know, like, why did you do this?" So, and the thought is often that, you know, there must be a reason, because why would God let a nice person suffer or something of this sort? And behind that is the thought that the whole world must somehow be fair and God really is in control of things here. And so, you know, if this happened, it must be because of something else somewhere else. This is the same mistake that Job's friends made when he was suffering, and they came and they said, "God wouldn't have let this happen to you unless you were like in sin or something like that." They had no idea why it was happening, and they became superstitious and had to be rebuked by God because they were reading the omens and thinking they could interpret nature and history that way. So we have to be very careful. Cause and effect in an open system. That's the biblical picture. Why don't we turn to God and close? The more we think about it, God, Your message to us in the Bible is amazing. Many of us here realizing in a new way, this is really true, what You taught. In fact, this is really the only explanation for what we see that is fully satisfying, that really corresponds to what's in front of us. Your Word has given us that. And we realize too then that the answer that You give us in Your Word, the personal relationship with You through Jesus Christ, that part must be true also. I would ask tonight, Lord, that some sitting here in the quiet of their own heart would right at this moment make the decision. Use their power of free choice. Not to put it off. Not to think someday I'm going to have to think more about this. Or not to think maybe. But to make the decision and say, "God, my answer to You tonight is yes. I want to know Jesus Christ. I want to have Your Spirit enter my life. The direction I've been going is leading nowhere. I've been away from You long enough. I'm coming back." We're so happy for those that prayed this tonight, Lord, like so many of the rest of us have in our own lives. And the answer that You gave us in Your indwelling Spirit and assuring us that You're with us and that You love us. We thank You for that in Christ's name. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.